You're listening to OU Podcasts.
Hey guys, welcome to Operation Ultra Podcast, episode 16. I'm Dustin.
And this is Rachel.
And you'll have to forgive me a little bit. My voice today, Rachel, is a little bit gone. We've kind of been passing around this chest cold, sinus stuff, whatever, between the family for the past couple of weeks. And, you know, I think I'm ready to get it over with.
I would prefer that you just keep it to yourself now.
And also this week, we signed up for our next event. Rachel, can you tell us a little bit about what you signed up for?
Sure. I think we've actually talked about it on the program a little bit, but I finally pulled the trigger and I am now officially signed up for my next 100, which is Cajun Coyote this December. And I'm actually dragging my good friend Kim to the race with me, which she was the reason that we did Rocky Raccoon last year. Actually, the reason we did Rocky Raccoon 50 the year before and then Rocky Raccoon 100, although if you speak to her, she says that all that was my fault.
I don't know who's to blame necessarily. I think you guys, it's a bad, vicious cycle with each of you. But and I signed up for the Inferno races. You know, we talked to race director Jeff Beck of both of these events, and we're looking forward to going down and meeting Jeff and getting to be subjected to the misery of these events. So while you have a long time to obsess and train for yours, I'd kind of taken a few weeks of lighter training and trying to get back into it now with this whole sickness. It's not been a lot of fun, but mine's coming up soon, so I don't know how that's going to go. Anyway, we're excited about that, and hopefully you'll get to hear a little bit more about our training as the weeks progress. Well, this week we get to feature some races that we haven't talked about before, and in a state that's kind of on the edge of what we define the Southeast as. We're going to talk about Epic Ultras, which is a group that manages a few events in the Kansas area. So first, we're going to talk to Mindy Kuhlman. And Mindy is kind of a relative newcomer to the ultra running scene, but she's had a quick progression and has run really, really well. She was first at the Ozark Trail 100 miles. She was first at the Flat Rock 50K, which is an Epic Ultras event. And we get to hear a little bit about her experience as a dietitian, her hallucinations, and how she got started running to begin with.
Mindy, you have had great success at ultra running. Give us a background on you yourself, what you do off the trail when you're not running.
I'm actually a registered dietitian. I work at a local hospital, and I'm the head of the clinical nutrition department and the dietary department. So I feel like being a clinical dietitian does help with the ultra running aspect of my life too. So,
oh, absolutely. And you know, we're excited to have a registered dietitian on the program. As far as that side goes, what advice would you give as far as the diet and the foods that work best for ultra runners?
A lot of runners start to neglect their nutrition as, you know, especially in the early miles of a race and as the race rolls on. I think one of my biggest thing is that I tell people quite a bit is eat early, eat often, and pay close attention to your electrolytes. It actually amazes me how many runners out there don't know to take salt or how much salt to take or how often to take it when it's hot and they're late in the race and things start to go south for them, you know, because they've neglected it too soon.
Is there a particular type of drink or food that you recommend for during the race?
I like Goo Brew. That one was probably my pick for a drink. As far as gels or something like that, I know they're not real popular in the ultra world. Usually people like real food in ultras. But I always carry gels as a backup in between aid stations, and I prefer the power gels. They're a thinner consistency, easier to take down, and I have several friends now that are using EFS nutrition supplements, and it's just liquid nutrition, liquid calories, and a couple of my friends really swear by it. They will use it through the entirety of a race and hardly eat food at aid stations, which is convenient. If they're trying to make a good time, they can keep moving with that. So
Mindy, as a dietitian, what foods do you graze on at an aid station? And I know the food varies a lot from race to race, but what is the strangest thing you've ever seen offered at an aid station?
Well, I guess it doesn't seem strange to me anymore, but I remember the first time I saw raw potatoes at an aid station. I thought, who eats raw potatoes? And I grabbed one and they suggested dipping it a little bit of salt. And I thought it was the best thing that I had ever found at an aid station. So I do a lot of the raw potatoes if the aid station has them. Not all races seem to put it out there.
Raw as in uncooked, the like the crunchy?
Uncooked.
Wow.
Yep, just whole potatoes. And it, I mean, really, I thought it was so strange. And it, I mean, you know, potatoes are such a readily available starch and they're complex, so they stay with you longer. They have fiber with them too. And so, you know, they don't run right through you. So they're actually kind of an ideal food to grab and go with. My other go-to are peanut butter and jelly sandwiches or ham sandwiches with mustard.
And you mentioned electrolytes. One of the things I remember listening to not too long ago was an interview with Tim Noakes. And Tim, you know, he's a medical doctor, really pretty well known in writing running books and material on running and nutrition. Kind of seems to suggest that we as runners tend to overhydrate and over consume salt. Do you think there's any validity to that, or do you think not enough attention is placed on it?
I think in the heat of the summer, if you're running an ultra, you definitely have to take in enough fluids and enough electrolytes. In the cold, I do think that is probably pretty valid. I ran a 50K and it was -7 this last March. And during that race, I think I maybe consumed 20 ounces of water at the most. And I took 2 salt caps and that was more than enough. And I could tell that it was more than enough just because the salt made me thirsty, not because I was sweating so much. So I do think it can be abused. However, I've seen other situations where this last weekend, in fact, I ran a 100K and I saw a runner who was starting to struggle and I started asking him questions and I asked if his fingers were swelling and things like that. And he said yes. And I asked him if he had taken salt and he hadn't. So I slept with him for a while and I gave him a couple salt caps and had him take them with minimal water, so I knew that he was thirst-basing fluid, so the salt would act to reabsorb some of that fluid back into the body's cells. And it turned his race around, and he ended up, you know, I stayed with him for about 5 miles, and when I decided to go ahead and go, he said, I'm good now. That, you know, made all the difference in the world. So I think people just need to pay attention to their own body and know the signs of low sodium, whether it's shakiness, goosebumps, finger swelling, you know, accelerated heart rate, things like that. And rather than putting it on a time schedule, try to pay attention to what your signs and symptoms are.
How did Free State 100K this past weekend go for you?
It was a rough day. This last winter was very cold in the Midwest, so I have been used to running in sub-zero temperatures, anywhere from -10 to 20 degrees, really. And it got up to 80 degrees. And because the winter was so cold, there's no leaves on the trees yet. So it was direct sunlight on the trail. And it was a loop course that we did 3 times. So my first loop, I ran pretty comfortable because it was cool. And then as it began to get hot, I knew I needed to slow down. So when my heart rate would go up because of the heat, I would just back off the pace. And I just took my time and paid a lot of attention to my body and made sure that I stayed on top of everything. And it ended up taking me about 13 hours. So it was over an hour and a half longer than the last time I ran that race. But with the conditions, I was actually still happy with that. I finished 2nd place female and 4th overall. So it was a pretty good day, all things considered.
Yeah, I was about to say, you struggled and say you had a rough day and you still came in 2nd. That's not too bad at all.
Yeah, I was happy.
So before we kind of go on to some of your other races that you've run, how did you get started into running?
Well, originally I just wanted to lose some weight from my first year of college, you know, the typical. And so I started just doing 4 miles every day and found that it just kind of set the tone for my entire day when I did that. I mean, I always had a better day when I would run. And then one morning I was driving to work. I lived in Lincoln, Nebraska, and I saw the Lincoln Marathon going on and was very confused why people were running in the rain. So I looked up stuff about it the next day and decided that I wanted to give it a try and get into doing marathons. And so I went straight to a marathon for my first ever race.
Wow, that's a pretty big jump. So what was your experience there like?
It was rough. It was very slow. It's still my slowest ever marathon time. It was Columbia, Missouri, and it's known as one of the hardest non-mountainous marathons. And I didn't know that at the time. I didn't know anything about it. I lived in Columbia, Missouri at the time, so I chose that one out of convenience. And I didn't know anybody else who ran marathons, so I thought if I have to run 26.2 miles, I guess I need to run really far in training. And I didn't know about tapering. I ran 14 miles the Friday before, and it was on Monday. It was on Labor Day every year. And so it went kind of as expected. I wanted to finish in under 5 hours, and I finished in 4:38, and I was overwhelmingly excited about it. I was pretty much hooked from then on. So
you said it was kind of a rough experience, but you're excited about it. So what made you decide to go then into ultra marathons?
Well, at the time that I decided to give trail running a try, I was doing a marathon a month, and there was a 20-mile trail race in Kansas City put on by the Trail Nerds. And I thought, well, I'm doing a marathon a month. I could do that 20 miler in February because there's no marathon that I'm going to go travel to, just so that I, you know, keep up some distance. And I assumed 20 miles I could do in, you know, about 3 hours. And I went out there and took off too fast because I had no idea what trail running was like, and blew up with about 5 miles into the race and finished in 4 hours and I think 24 minutes. And I was so sore the next day that I could hardly get off the couch, and I couldn't believe that with the marathon shape that I was in, that a trail race could do that to me. And so I thought, if I can do 20 miles on that and feel like this, how incredible would it be, or what kind of shape would I have to be in to do an ultra? Could my body handle that? So a year later, I did my first ultra at the same race, and it was a 50K.
From there, you've progressed on up, and it looks like you've been smart and kind of slowly stepped up into the distance rather than like you jumped into marathons straight away. You didn't jump up straight to 100 milers. So how did you kind of build over time?
Well, I did my first 50K in February of 2011, and then in April, I did a 40 miler, and May, I did another 50K. And so I just kind of consistently kept those distances on my schedule and would just select the next highest distance as time went on. In preparation for my first 100, I did a 50K in February, the same one that I try to always do now. And then 3 days of Sylamo is a race in Arkansas that they do a 50K on Friday, 50-miler Saturday, and 20K on Sunday. So I did that one, and then I did 100, and that one was in March. So then in April, I did 100K. So in preparation for my first 100, I just used those stages of distances to build up for it. And after the 100K, then 6 weeks later, I did my first 100. So I tried to take the advice of other experienced ultra runners who said, you know, don't do too far too fast. Use those races to train for other races.
What was your experience like at your first 100? And was that was Kettle Moraine, correct?
Correct, yes. I started out actually too slow. I was trying to help a friend get to his first 100. And I stayed with him for 62 miles. And, you know, you do have to run a pace you're comfortable with. And I was not comfortable running a 13.5-minute pace that I was trying to do for his sake. And we were spending too much time at aid stations. I would lock up. I am usually in and out of aid stations in under 2 minutes, even at 100 milers. And we were at aid stations for over 30 minutes. And finally at mile 62, I just pulled away and went on my own. And I kept a pretty solid 10-minute mile pace for about probably 20 miles. And then, you know, the mile started to catch up with me and I slowed back down. But it was a good first experience and good learning lesson not to run somebody else's pace at 100. I mean, that's a recipe for disaster and you need to run your pace.
And then you went on to do the Ozark Trail 100 in 2013, last year, and there you placed a first female. A lot went right for you at that race. What made it such a good race for you?
That was the best race of my running career. In leading up to that, I again used races in September to prepare for it. I ran a marathon, a 50-miler, and then a 50K, all 2 weeks apart, and or each 2 weeks apart. And then I took a really good taper, and that's not typical for me. I have a hard time tapering. So I, after the 50K, Flat Rock 50K, I started my taper essentially then, and that was 5 weeks out. So I just decreased my mileage every week, and everything went right at Ozark Trail from the start. I did my nutrition well the day before, and you know, you never sleep well the night before a race, but I did well leading up to it that week of, and during the race, I, you know, followed the advice that I give people. I ate early, I ate often, and I used the hills to give my body a break. And I think that saved my race in a lot of ways. I walked all the hills in the beginning that were long and steep, and late in the race, I was still able to run. I ran up to 94 miles, but I had taken a pretty bad fall around mile 76, and eventually it reduced me to walking about the last 10 miles. That course is about 104 miles long.
Not only did you place first female, but you ran it in well under 24 hours. And on that kind of course, the Ozark Trail course is notoriously difficult and a little rugged, maybe not easy to follow at times. How did you get through that? I mean, what was the course as difficult as advertised?
It was really hard when it got dark and I was trying to use my headlamp. I actually hallucinated for the first time ever in a race, which I always kind of thought, oh, people exaggerate those stories. It can't be that bad. Well, I picked up a pacer the last 36 miles, and I didn't use a pacer for my first 100, and I thought, well, this one being in the Ozarks and stuff, I would probably feel better having someone with me. And I'm really grateful I did. He kind of helped me keep my wits about me as the miles got longer. And I think it was somewhere around mile 86 or something when I started hallucinating. I thought there was a person standing in front of me. Then I thought I saw a wild boar, and I thought I saw puppies that I bent down and tried to talk to. And I thought I saw a donkey, and I mean, just all kinds of stuff out there. And it was literally freaking me out. I would, when I thought I saw the wild boar, I screamed and tried to run down the hill.
So you went from not hallucinating ever to really going all in on hallucinations.
Yeah. And my pacer, you know, had to talk me out of it a couple of times. Like, when I thought I saw the boar, I thought it was going to, you know, attack me. They're not friendly wild animals. And he just talked me through it. Just, Mindy, there's nothing there. Those are leaves. You're looking at leaves. There's nothing there. And I said, no, I can see it. I can see its snout. I can see everything about it. And he said, no, it's not there. And finally, I just decided to trust him and decided to tell myself, yeah, you're probably losing your mind. He probably knows what he's talking about. So, and then at one point, I had started slowing down. And he asked if I wanted to run what looked like a pretty runnable section. And I told him I didn't think I could. And he asked me, when was the last time you took in nutrition? And I didn't have an answer for him. And so I took a gel and I drank some water and I drank some electrolytes. And within 2 minutes, I was feeling good and ready to run again. So having him there really, really helped. And we also have trained together for the last several years. So that helped. He knew the signs of when I'm not myself.
Yeah, those hallucinations can be pretty tough late in a race. And it's funny how you said it was just leaves that you were seeing in my 100 milers. The leaves to me looked like blood on the trail. And I kept thinking, somebody has been bleeding all down this trail. And I had seen at one point what at least I thought was a guy running towards me with blood just dripping down his face. So after that, I just saw blood the whole night. And I kept telling myself, it's just leaves. It's just leaves. But yeah, leaves can be kind of a scary thing out on a trail.
They can. They change shapes, and large rocks were what I thought. I thought a large rock was a donkey. But yeah, mostly with leaves. The wind blew the leaves, and they moved, and that's when I thought I saw puppies. And I bent down, and I said, look, it's a puppy. Come here. Come here. And I was talking to it, and my pacer said, Mindy, there's no puppy. You need to keep moving. And I said, no, look. Okay, you're probably right. And I kept moving.
My hallucination experience the first time, I've done 200s. My first 100 was, I never really quite believed they were there, but I completely saw things. But I saw gorillas, the trees, the bottom of the tree, kind of the way it was shaped. I was thinking they were gorillas, like literally sitting on the side of the trail. But I kept telling myself, they're not real. They're not real.
Yeah, I did get better at that later in the race. I could convince myself that what I thought I was seeing wasn't real. But when they first started happening, because it's never happened to me before, I mean, they were as real as the person behind me.
Since you're a dietitian, do you feel there's maybe a little extra pressure on you to get the nutrition part right in races?
Yes, I do. And I've had people say to me before when I have had a bad experience at a race, and I say my stomach went south, I was throwing up, or you know, something like that. I've had people say, as a dietitian, I wouldn't think that would ever happen to you. And I kind of have to say, you know, I'm still human. I still fall victim to the same things that everyone does as far as, you know, starting out too fast is because you think you feel too good. Your nutrition's going to go south as a result of that because you're not going to digest food the same. But I've had a lot of people that they ask my advice, and then when they see me have a bad day or struggle, I actually had two races where I had my nutrition go south and threw up and those kinds of things. I feel like it takes away some of my credibility for what I know to be the right thing to do. And I just have to admit that I made a mistake, and just like anybody else can.
And on the nutrition side, I've noticed that you said your favorite pre-race meal is actually Chipotle. And just in my mind, I love Chipotle, but I'm thinking serving size. Those burritos at Chipotle are massive. Is that typically what you get, a burrito, and are you eating the whole thing?
I do the burrito bowl, and depending on the distance of the race, yes, I usually eat the entire thing. I don't eat a lot of gluten the day before a race, just because I've noticed that it gives me GI issues during a race. So I do the bowl so I don't have the tortilla. The tortilla does add a lot too. So yeah, I can usually handle eating all of it.
I guess when a dietitian answers, what is your pre-race meal? You expect something like, a nice salmon on a bed of salad or something like that. Not Chipotle.
Yeah, that's true. The good thing about Chipotle, and these are the things about it that make it my perfect meal. One, it's the rice. I swear by rice as my carb loading as opposed to pasta or something of that nature. It's high in sodium. So after eating that, I can drink a lot of water and kind of build up my sodium store, especially if it's going to be a hot race. I always put guacamole on it, and that is an excellent source of healthy fat, and it's high in calories and digested well by the body and recognized well. So while it seems like fast food of fast food choices, it's, you know, a little healthier than, you know, thinking going to go through McDonald's or something.
I love the idea of it. So on our next race, Rachel, we're going to go find a Chipotle as our pre-race meal. And one of the things we noticed in stalking your ultra sign-up results was you also, you know, you did 3 days of Sylamo. We're from Arkansas, so we obviously know and like the trail that's on. But you also you also did a stage race at Tahoe. So first, can you tell us a little bit about that stage race at Tahoe? Tahoe has to be one of my favorite places in the U.S.
Yes, it was absolutely beautiful. It was a marathon Friday, a marathon Saturday, and then Saturday night at 10 p.m., 72 miles. And I was under trained. I mean, it was jumping to a distance much farther than I had completed. My farthest distance in training was the 40-mile race that I did in the spring. And so I did the first marathon, very conservative. I think I ran a 4:27, maybe something like that, which is considerably slower than most of my marathons. And then Saturday morning, I ran a 4:07. And then Saturday night, during the 72-miler, first I ate too much before the start of the race. And so the first 10 miles, I just felt awful. And then as I started to feel good, as my food was digesting, I was running down a hill about mile 27. I came down hard on my foot, and I felt something change in my leg. And I stumbled, I limped for a little bit, and I was running this with a friend. And I said, I think I just broke my leg. And he said, you didn't break your leg. You wouldn't be still running if you broke your leg. And I kind of thought about that, and I thought, you're right. You know, that's probably true. I wouldn't be running on it. And so when we got to the next aid station, we had an aid car, actually. There's no aid stations at the 72. You have to use by your own. I wrapped up my ankle, and I kept going, and it just got worse and worse, and the pain was excruciating. We ran all the way to 46 miles, and the third day, there's also a marathon that goes on, and it starts in the morning. We made it past the start line before it started, and so then all the marathoners came running by, and by that time, I was done running. I was in too much pain, so we power walked the last almost 26 solid miles, and when I finished, I looked down at my ankle, and it was over my shoe. I'd refused to look at it the entire time, and I went to the doctor 2 days later, and I had multiple fractures in my distal tibia, and that was by far my most painful race experience, which, looking back, I would have been smarter to stop, but at the same time, it gives me a lot of perspective. Like, when I'm late in a 100-miler and everything hurts, and I think to myself, nothing's broken, nothing's bleeding, nothing's, well, sometimes there's things bleeding, but I fall down a lot. But, you know, I kind of can think through that and think, you're just tired. This is how you're supposed to feel, and this does not hurt that bad. And so in spite of it being very painful and very difficult, it definitely gave me good perspective for other races.
That brings up a good question. I'll be doing my first stage race here. Forge Racing in Louisiana is putting on its three basically 25-mile races approximately over 2 days. Any good advice for how to handle a stage race and doing that many races so close together?
Yeah, the thing that I learned from my experiences with stage races is the most important part is trying to get sleep in between each race. The only time the body recovers or repairs itself is while we're asleep. The other part is not to burn through your glycogen stores during the race. We're so used to thinking of one race, you have to think of the big picture. And so when I ran, for example, 3 days of Sulamo, at the 50K, I think I ran 6 hours, 13 or 23 minutes, something in there. I don't remember exactly, but I was very, very conservative. I mean, I was singing the whole time and laughing, and I finished feeling like I had just gone for a 10-mile jog. And so staying conservative on your pace, eating, making sure you eat almost immediately after, because our body absorbs or reabsorbs glycogen stores at maximum capacity within 30 minutes after you complete exercise. So that part is extremely important, and eating well the night before and before you go to bed too.
Okay, eating and sleeping. I can definitely handle those two things.
Yes.
And then one other, there was a great, you were featured in Epic Ultra's kind of their newsletter in February 2014. And so I'll kind of briefly touch on it. You don't have to go into too much detail, but you mentioned in May of last year, you kind of closed a difficult chapter of your life. A lot of us do ultra running as kind of our hobby because we enjoy doing these things. But for you, is ultra running, does it kind of get to be that
maybe a healing or a growth experience to where when you're going through those difficult things, you can, you know, go on a long trail run or do a long trail race and kind of let your mind heal from some of those difficult things that you might go through?
I can say that honestly, yes, it was. It used to be that. It used to be the one aspect in my life while I was going to school and trying to make it on my own. And that difficult chapter in my life was an 8-month unpaid internship that just, I burned the candle at both ends for 8 solid months. And during those times, I kept running because it was the only thing that I could do for myself. It was the only thing I could take with me. And, you know, because I moved to Florida for the internship, and it was the only part of me that I got to continue for me, just for me. And I think that's what got me into running initially is, well, kept me running initially, I guess I should say, was that I learned that it was my thing. It was my time to just think about me. But now that my life has slowed down and I'm now in the career that I have worked so hard to obtain, now I get to enjoy it in a different aspect. Now I get to enjoy the nature side of it, the appreciation of being outdoors, not so much to clear my mind.
Mindy, I appreciate you taking the time on here with us, and congratulations on your race this past weekend, and we look forward to see how you do at Flat Rock this fall.
So I think when a lot of folks, we ask this question about why do you run, everybody mentions the community aspect. If there was a close second or maybe even a tide for that, I think just getting outside, getting into the woods, getting in the great outdoors is also something that a lot of folks are really drawn to.
The woods definitely offer a peaceful zen environment where you can just kind of kick back, take your headphones off and listen to the sounds of nature. I love exploring. I'm always paying attention to what's on the trail, whether it's a beautiful little flower or a mushroom or a new insect that I've never seen or even a friendly little snake.
And it's weird. I'm kind of the opposite there. I don't pay much attention. Being outside, being in the great outdoors is kind of my way to escape from those things. And I kind of maybe zone out in my own world. So I guess it's still the same thing. It's still the same reason, but we each have ways we fulfill that. So we enjoyed talking to Mindy, and we wish her the best of luck at her upcoming races. So next we get to talk to Eric Steele. Eric is the founder of Epic Ultras and puts on a lot of events. He's been running a long time. He was the first Kansan to complete Badwater. He was the founder of Kansas's oldest ultra, which is the Flat Rock 50K, and that's a big, really popular event. And we get to talk to Eric about how he started running, how he started this Epic Ultras business, and his experiences as an ultra runner.
To start off, I want to talk a little bit about you, Eric, and you've got over 20 years experience in running and in ultra running at that, I think. So tell me, how did you get started running?
Oh, gee, it's been a long time since I've answered a question like that. Really, I was in my mid to late 20s and was just really out of shape, had been pretty fit as a kid and a teenager, and played mainly team type of sports growing up and never ran in high school or anything. But in my mid to late 20s, I wasn't really overweight, but I smoked about a pack a day and was just, you know, just, I was just feeling really listless and like just not, you know, not right. Like that, there's more to life than this. And I had toyed around with running for a few years, seeing people do it. So really with a challenge with my wife at the time was just, if she would get in shape, then I would get in shape and start running. And so I took off and couldn't quite make it a mile that day. And the rest really is history, as the saying goes, because I just basically stuck with it. And within a couple years of running, you know, is when I ran my first marathon a year after actually just starting running, and my first ultra a couple years later, and I've been running for 22 years now. So really just a thing of kind of personal challenge and not really being happy with where I was and just knowing that there was a lot to be had to being physically fit, and running was the easiest, in many ways, the easiest thing to do. I think another thing that really motivated it at that point in life was, you know, a lot of my friends that I'd used to play team sports with and even pick up stuff with, by the mid to late 20s, we were all married and doing our own thing. And it was just, it's hard to find groups really to do sports with anymore. And so the running thing really really had a lot of appeal to me just because you could do it by yourself.
That's a good story getting into running in general, but you know, most folks will run 5Ks, 10Ks, half marathons, or maybe even marathons. But what drew you so quickly into going beyond the marathon distance?
It's absolutely the people. The people that I met at my first ultra race back in 1994 was they were just different, and they were just more philosophical. I'm not even sure if that would be the right word, but they just struck me as being a lot more down to earth. And even though, like, the initial insanity of biting off distances, you know, doing my first ultra was actually a 12-hour event where I finished 100K, and just the concept of running for that many hours, whether it's a specific distance or a timed event, it was a fringe thing. It was crazy. I mean, literally. And I thought, I've got to go check this out. And then the people that I met there, you know, I don't want to sound negative toward road runners and people in shorter distance running communities, but I was immediately attracted to the character of the people that were involved with ultra sport out of the gate. And so a year later, I actually founded the Kansas Ultra Runner Society in 1995 with a couple of the guys I'd actually met at that first race.
That's an answer we hear from so many others, that the community is what keeps them there, at least. And you know, I think that's true for most all of us. And you've been able to successfully do something that a lot of folks don't. You started and have run consistently. You know, looking at your results on Ultra Sign Up, there's not much gap at all in between, you know, for any significant time period, yet you've been able to start a group that actually directs races. And first, I guess, tell us about Epic Ultras and what Epic Ultras is.
Epic Ultras is a company that I started, that they founded about, it's almost 2 years ago now. And we now have 7 different races that we manage on the calendar here in Kansas, ranging everything from a real simple, even though technically it's not an ultra, but we have a little fat ass 25 and 12K to kick off the year in January. And then throughout the year, we have events that range from 50 kilometers up through 100 miles, and everything from really extremely rugged, difficult single track to easy rails to trails type of stuff. And that was the whole idea when I started the company, was that I was really wanting to provide an excellent venue of races that were everything from beginner friendly type of stuff that had extremely liberal cutoff times to really encourage the newbies to come out and give it a shot, all the way through some what I call graduate level hardcore single track, which is our Flat Rock course down outside of Independence, Kansas. And then some just sicko heat stuff like Honey Badger that's real, you know, comparable to like a Badwater.
Flat Rock 101K this weekend is a fairly new race compared to your traditional Flat Rock 50K that's in the fall. So what is the difference between those two other than distance? Are they the similar area? Are they run along the same trail?
Yes, it's run on the same trail that our 50K is. It's a double out and back instead of just a single, which is what our 50K in the fall is. And we've had enough participants over the years that have come to me and said, hey, you know, this would make a really gnarly 100K. And so after being badgered enough for a number of years, we decided to start a 101K, which we started last year. And really, that trail is so rugged. We've had less than around 1.5% of the 50K finishers in the 19-year history of the race have ever broken 5 hours on this course. So it's really become very well known as being an extremely graduate level course and then some. I mean, I actually book it as the toughest race, you know, of that type of distance in the Midwest. I've had people that have done the Bandera 100K, and I'm good friends with Joe Prusadis, and I've done Bandera myself, and that's a tough 100K. But I've had people that have done that, because that's booked as a really tough race. That the Flat Rock 101 is way tougher. So yes, it's a double out and back on that course. The field, I've got right now 49 runners registered from 9 different states, I believe. But once again, it's an extremely tough course. If you compare that to the race we wrapped up 3 weeks ago, the Prairie Spirit Trail 150-mile races, which are on a rails-to-trails course that runs from Ottawa, Kansas, down to Iola, which, is, like I said, it's rails-to-trails, extremely flat, extremely beginner-friendly. I had a little over 200 runners register from 20 different states for that. So, yeah, I mean, you know, it just kind of has to do with, I think a lot of it has to do with the difficulty level of it. I've certainly marketed and promoted both of those races pretty close to, you know, with the same, you know, I've marketed them both pretty heavily, and I found it real interesting. I think a lot of it just has to do with the rugged level of the course once again. And I've had people suggest to me that I should add some shorter distances, but that wasn't what Found in This Company was all about to me. There's a couple of these races like Honey Badger, the same thing. People say, well, aren't you going to have a 50-mile option or a 50K option? It's like, well, we have some easier races if you want to do them, but a couple of these races are purposefully hardcore like these two I'm mentioning, and they're just strictly those distances. Because I still think there's a lot to be said, you know, for this sport in general about keeping, a couple of your races, at least in my opinion, really hardcore that, you know, require a lot of training and a lot of guts to actually step up and do.
What is it about the Flat Rock course that makes it so difficult? Is it the footing? Is it the elevation change? Tell us a little bit about the course.
Yeah, it's absolutely the technical footing and the difficulty of it. The motto at the course from the very beginning is, if you look up, you're going down. And, you know, I coined that clear back in the mid-90s when we first started it. I'll also mention that the 50K is the oldest ultra in the state. It's not just the oldest trail ultra, but it's the oldest ultra. It dates back longer than any ultra in the state of Kansas. It's very rocky, hence the term flat rock, very rooty as well. There's no significantly long climbs. There's just tons of little short ones. The trail follows, runs along the north part of the lake, and it runs up on bluffs, but then it cuts down in between a lot of coves that lead back off of the lake. It's extremely difficult to get any kind of real rhythm on this trail, except for about 3 miles of it on the extreme west end. So it's just a very technical trail. And the thing is, people from, you know, people, a race in Kansas, and this has, of course, always been the comedy over the years with this course, is I have runners that have come in from California and Colorado and are absolutely just blown away by it because they think they've ran in mountainous stuff, and how difficult can a trail in Kansas be? But once again, I'll just go back to a less than 2% finishing rate in sub 5 hours in 19 years of running the race. So yeah, just really technical footing, but it's extremely beautiful area for Kansas. It's a lot more similar to the Ozarks. And I would even say, you know, kind of like Southern Missouri and Northern Arkansas, you know, it's down in that corner of the state closer to Missouri and Arkansas. It's a lot more reminiscent of those types of areas.
At the Prairie Spirit, you brought Dr. David Horton out. Dr. David Horton was one of our podcast interviews from a couple of months back or so, and so you brought him to speak to the runners the night before the event. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct. And just a little brief background on that. My primary business partner, Warren Bushy, that assists with all the events. Warren and I crewed for Dr. Horton back in 1995, the Trans Am race he competed in that year. We crewed for him for 9 days across the state of Kansas, and that's where we had originally met Dave. And yeah, it was a huge hit. I mean, Dave's a great guy. The time that we spent with him, I just felt real strongly that all the runners would really, you know, appreciate his presentation and him being there. And of course, how interpersonal Dave is and interacting with all of the runners. And we had a bike for him, so he was out on the course during the day because, you know, bikes are allowed on the course, and he was out encouraging runners, and he's so approachable, and it was huge. But we look at that again in this organization of things that we can do in a way to, you know, give to the runners, take the experience to the next level for them, et cetera, et cetera. And so we were just super excited that he agreed to come in, and that that he was so well received, and it was a great time. And I'll just drop a little bug there. We're working on some other presenters in the future, of course. One of the main things that we mention constantly in most of our promotional stuff is come co-create an ultra-running experience of a lifetime with us. And the reason, of course, we use that word co-create is because it is. It's a process of the race directors and race organization, you know, the management, providing the platform, more so to speak, for the runners, and then the runners coming in and doing their part by competing. And in the end, you have an ultra running experience of a lifetime. And we go back to that constantly. You know, what can we do to raise the bar? What can we do to take it to the next level? In many ways, just embodying the sport itself, like you are as a competitor. Well, what can you do as a race organizer and race management, to continue to just provide outstanding value and absolutely, you know, awesome experience, or an epic experience, of course, at your events.
And you've got another inaugural event coming up this year, the inaugural Honey Badger 100 miler. So, of course, I think most of us know where the Honey Badger name comes from. But tell us a little bit about that event and what merits the Honey Badger title.
Well, actually, let's talk about that, and hopefully we'll have time to mention one more. But before that, we actually have another inaugural event at the end of May, the Flint Hills Trail 40-mile marathon. But to get to the Honey Badger, because, of course, I think this can be a really fun one. Well, you know, the Honey Badger is supposedly the toughest animal on Earth, so that's where that initially, you know, the initial kind of idea. Well, come on, let's. What's a catchy name for an ultra in the middle of the summer? But the original idea, of course, is born from Badwater. Basically, I was the first Kansan actually to finish Badwater back in 2000, and for a number of years, this is another one of these things that several of my running buddies and people that have known me for a number of years are like, you need to come up with something like that for Kansas. You need to stage something like that for the state. And so it was born out of just the idea of, all right, let's do something in the middle of the summer, and let's do it on asphalt. And of course, it's not 135. We're going to keep it to 100 miler, but it's going to be similar in the sense that it's going to be a self-crewed race. It's going to be on asphalt. We're going to put it smack dab in the middle of July, so it's the hottest, you know, possible time of the year. Kingman County, where the entire race is held, we've basically got about an 8.75 miles we're running people in a state park, and then there's about a little over a 91-mile actual loop, a point-to-point loop that's all in Kingman County. Kingman County is one of the windiest counties in the state of Kansas. The largest wind farm in the state is located in Kingman County. So it'll be convection oven type of, you know, heat, you know, hot, windy type of conditions. The asphalt that runs on the county roads, we're using no major highways of any kind. There's no commercial through traffic allowed on the roads that we have, that the race is the event is set up on. Extremely flat asphalt roads with virtually no cant and a huge shoulder, very, very minimal traffic. So once again, keeping the overall conditions as close, and really a lot of people that have emailed me, a lot of runners that have emailed me asking me about it, it's like, as far as a mini Badwater, it's as close as you're going to get to it relative to simulating course conditions without all the vicious climbs that, of course, you have at Badwater. But like, could you go out? Do you have a crew that could go out and do this for you for a significant period of time? Can you actually, you know, run in heat like this? Because, of course, you know, a lot of people don't realize is the heat that's coming off of the asphalt, it still makes it anywhere from 15 to 20 degrees hotter than it actually is in the real temperature outside. So yeah, just the whole challenge of doing a road 100 that's similar to a Badwater, and then, well, what are we going to call this? And of course, as you mentioned, the whole Honey Badger thing's been going around for several years now, and it's kind of comical, but by the same token, the Guinness Book of World Records claims that it is the toughest animal. Honey Badger 100 is born.
I think the heat in July in the middle of Kansas on the asphalt definitely deserves the name. And it would only be sadistic if you threw in some big hills there to go along with it.
Well, the one other thing I will mention, The biggest difference between this and Badwater is what we are providing is every competitor has to have a crew vehicle, once again, similar to Badwater, that's with them the whole time, that is providing all of their aid for them. But what we are providing is water and ice. We are actually going to have a couple vehicles, a couple, you know, trucks that will be roving the course and providing actual water and ice for the crew vehicles. The whole idea being that with a full tank of gas, you'd never have to leave the course, you know, if you bring the proper supplies out there, and we will be providing the ice and the water for the actual crew vehicles.
And you mentioned the heat. What does the heat look like in at that time in July in Kansas?
Typically, a cool day in the middle of July is the upper 90s. But a lot of times, you know, you'll see it break 100 fairly easily. And then once again, with the heat coming off the pavement and all the wind, I mean, you know, real temperatures could definitely break one. We could definitely break 110. And I mean, that's just something I'll mention again. When I did Badwater, we had a thermometer hanging in the back of the minivan, up, but basically one of the handles that you hold on to. So, you know, approximately 4.5 feet off the ground. And it was hitting 140 to 145, which was basically 20 to 25 degrees hotter than the actual temperature that supposedly was in the air. But once again, the heat coming off of the black asphalt raises that by a minimum of 10 to 15 degrees. So real temperature, I think, in July running out there, you know, I'm going to be conservative and say definitely 110 plus, but I think it could probably get 115 to 120 without a problem. And then once again with the wind, and of course in Kansas it can still be a little more humid. I mean, you know, the one thing, and everybody still says, no, you know, 120 degrees is 120 degrees. Well, no, because depending on the humidity in the air and you know, out in Death Valley, you have virtually none. And in Kansas, we can still get a significant amount of humidity with that type of heat in July. So, yeah, it'll be a fun one for sure.
I could definitely see that being a pretty difficult race. You're putting on a number of races, and in your running career, you've gotten to run a lot of races. What do you think is your favorite race, or at least the number one on your list? And have you run it yet, or is it a race that's on your bucket list?
You know, that is an extremely difficult question, simply because there's so many ultras out there now. I know one that's on the bucket list that just has, of course, the incredible history of the sport, and that's the Comrades Marathon. And that's something that has been on the bucket list for a long time. And I think, you know, that's kind of like running Boston. And back when I, you know, actually ran road marathons, I was fortunate enough to participate in Boston's 100th marathon in 96. And actually, it was a really unique time to still be kind of doing the road marathon stuff, because I did Disney's inaugural marathon in 94, and then I did Boston's 100th in 96. And so Comrades has always been that ultimate ultra, because, you know, the history of that race is pretty much being, you know, the premier ultra for so many years now. I think I would probably say it's that. But it's so difficult, because this sport has just exploded in the last 10 years. I mean, it really has. It's mind-boggling how many races have showed up. But like anything, I think the question still is, you know, the quality of them, so on and so forth. You know, at certain times I'd fancy doing Hard Rock, but I'm 48 years old. I don't think I got it in me. I don't know. You know, I finished Leadville back in 99, the Leadville Trail 100 in 99. And that was certainly, you know, it took me 3 attempts to do that. And that was certainly a phenomenal event. Of course, I know with, you know, the last couple of years that there's been some growth struggles going on there. So yeah, really, I think to answer that question, I'd have to say Comrades, simply because of the tradition and the history.
And with your limited time while you're race directing, do you have anything put on your schedule right now?
Yeah, actually, I'm registered, and you know, this is kind of a hit and miss thing for me, depending on the time of the year. But my next registered race is a 50 kilometer race in Goddard, which is a little town just west of here. The race is mainly on country roads. I think about 7 miles of it's on asphalt. But a little over a week ago from this last weekend, I competed in a 50K down outside of Stillwater, Oklahoma, at Lake McMurtry, and placed fourth in a time of 5:14. And I'm 6'5", weigh about 190 pounds. I'm built like a basketball player, not an ultra runner. And so I'm still really super happy with the kind of speed. And, I really thought my body would kind of be falling apart by my late 40s. And I'm actually getting close to times that I ran, over 10 years ago and stuff, which is really exciting. So, yeah, I generally manage still to squeeze in about 4 to 5 races a year is what my goal is. I suffered an injury around the end of last year. I think I got in 3 races last year. And I know you mentioned like an ultra sign up before. And yeah, I've managed to stay in the game now for this literally is my 20th anniversary this month for doing ultras. And I have 4 children, 3 of them are raised. And so there were some years that were a little more scant than others. But, I always just kept coming back to it simply because there's nothing that's been able to really come close to it as far as being able to kind of set my sense of adventure on fire and truly provides a platform once again for a true sense of accomplishment, which is once again why I think I put them on too, because I've always believed that once you really discover something that you think is great and is life transforming, as I like to say about ultras, that you do your best to try to share that with people.
Well, we wish you the best of luck this weekend with the race, and we look forward to hearing great reports, and hopefully it doesn't get too hot for you this weekend and that you have great weather at Flat Rock.
Yeah, I think it's going to be nice. They're talking about potential for severe thunderstorms, but we've dealt with that down there before, and that's kind of part of this sport too, is weather doesn't tend to really, cancel things down. A lot of ultra runners look at it as being part of the challenge. So yeah, I think it's going to be another epic event, of course.
We had some pretty nasty weather Sunday in central Arkansas. Saturday was great. So hopefully in Kansas they had great weather. I'm afraid though, they may have had some of that rain before it came down here. So if you ran the Flat Rock 101K, we'd love to hear from you how it went. So send us an email.
Thanks for joining us on this podcast. If you like what you heard, make sure you head over to iTunes and subscribe to our podcast. While you're there, if you don't mind doing us a favor and leave a comment and a rating, that does a great deal to help us get the word out to other people.
And of course, we're all over social media. You can reach us on Facebook at facebook.com/Operation Ultra. You can hit us up on Twitter, twitter.com/Operation Ultra. We're at Operation Ultra. Use the hashtag OpUltra. Or you can just send us a plain old email, info@OperationUltra.com. Well, I think that kind of wraps it up for this week. And hopefully next week, my voice will be back to normal. You guys don't have to deal with this deep raspiness that I've got going on. So until next time,
happy trails.
And we'll see you next week.